Welcome to this Forthright Radio for September 26th, 2020. I'm Joy LeClaire. Our guest today on Forthright Radio is Senior Senator from Montana, John Tester. In addition to being the only working farmer in the U.S. Senate, and an organic farmer at that, he has now written a memoir, Grounded, A Senator's Lessons on Winning Back Rural America, just published by Echo Press. John Tester entered the U.S. Senate in 2006 and was re-elected for a third term in 2018 in spite of having been the recipient of Donald Trump's ire for having announced the unsuitability of his nominee for Director of Veterans Affairs, his personal physician, Dr. Ronald Jackson, because more than two dozen whistleblowers had reported serious, credible problems with Dr. Jackson's nomination. After Jackson withdrew his name, Trump flew to Montana four times to campaign against Senator Tester. Donald Trump Jr. came four other times, and Vice President Pence also came, each determined to defeat John Tester. However, notwithstanding the fact that Trump had won the state of Montana in 2016 by about 20 points, not only did Senator Tester get re-elected in 2018, but by a larger percentage of the vote than in any of his previous elections. In these polarized times, when power trumps propriety, when those who serve are seen as suckers and losers, when science and good sense are subsumed in phantasmagorical conspiracies, there are those few who remain true to their roots, who not only believe in democracy, but struggle to maintain it against ever-increasing odds. Such a one is Senator Tester. We recorded this interview on September 23rd, 2020. Welcome to Forthright Radio, Senator John Tester. Your book, Grounded, A Senator's Lessons on Winning Back Rural America, has just been published by Echo Books. It's a memoir and chronicles people and events in your life that have helped shape your character and the federal legislator that you have become. Among the things one learns from reading it is the role of women in your life. Let's begin with who they are and how they have influenced you, beginning with your maternal grandmother, Christine Anderson Pearson, her daughter, your mother, Helen Pearson Tester, and your wife, Sharla Bitts Tester.
Of the homesteader era, she came and homesteaded with my grandfather where we live today, west of Big Sandy. She was a very, very, what I would call a strong-willed. She was to Grandpa what my wife is to me and what my mother was to my dad. And that is, she was the rock that he leaned on. She was the person that allowed him to be successful. And it showed. My grandpa passed away in 1962, I believe it was. And I will tell you that, you know, I was very young. I remember Grandpa, but I certainly wasn't able to have conversations with him. My grandmother lived until I was 16, and she was somebody that lived in Big Sandy, and I would get over to her house very often, and somebody that set an incredible example to me on why you should pay attention to the world around you and what is going on and get involved in that world. And so that's her. My mother was very similar to my grandmother. She was a very, very strong woman and raised three boys and got us all through college. And I might add that my grandmother had four children, a boy and three girls. The boy did not go to college, but the three girls did, and they all graduated. Education was always a big thing in her life. Education was a massive thing in my mother's life. She always called it the great equalizer. And she said, you know, there's two things in this world that has made this country great. One is family farm agriculture, and the other is public education. And that's one of the reasons I went to school and became a public education teacher in music. But my mother also was connected to the land in a way that not many people are these days, and could smell and taste the soil and really determine a lot of things from that, which is really basic to farming, by the way. You can tell soil health from the smell and the taste, and people think, well, that's kind of crazy, you know, how do you do that? But the truth is that healthy soil has a different smell and it has a different taste. And you have to have healthy soil if you're going to raise healthy food. My wife, you know, I got lucky, man. I picked right. And we went out together for about, I think, 10 months from the time I took her on the first date till the time we had our wedding day. She's just a marvelous woman. She comes from the same area I do. Her grandparents and parents have the same kind of background that mine do as homesteaders and folks who lived in that region in north central Montana. But Charlotte's somebody who's just been the foundation of our family. She's been somebody that keeps me on the straight and narrow and keeps me, you know, plumb and square and level. And I'll just tell you that. I mean, any time that I come home and complain, if it's something that deserves that kind of recognition, she'll listen and respond. But oftentimes, you know, people complain just because they got a bad attitude, and she'll straighten you out. You start doing that, and she is truly the person who has kept me grounded. You know, we've been married for 43 years now. I was young when I got married. She was younger. We were 21 and 19. But quite frankly, it's worked. And like I said, I got lucky. That's all I got to tell you.
Well, you've got to share your first encounter with our listeners. Now, you had been eyeing her for a while, but it wasn't until a fateful softball game where she was the pitcher and you were the batter. What happened then?
Yeah, so, you know, I'd seen her in Big Sandy. Her dad was in the banking industry and took over their family farm in 1975, and that was west of Box Elder. And for those of you that know north central Montana and Box Elder, Big Sandy, about 10 miles apart. So there, it's the same area. So and they went to school in Big Sandy. I had graduated from high school. She was a senior in high school, and I saw her at a football game. I thought, man, oh, man, she's really pretty sharp. And so I always wanted to visit with her. I wasn't exactly the most outgoing guy when it came to girls anyway. And at any rate, fate happened that we ended up, her folks went to the same church my folks did too. And so I'd see her in church. And I went to a youth event, a barbecue, and for the church, and hoping that she'd be there. And by golly, she was. And got a chance to interact with her a little bit. And then we decided to go play a game of softball out in the middle of a cow pasture, which is what you do. And she was pitching and I was batting. I told her that I was going to hit a home run, and she told me she was going to strike me out. And, I don't know. She struck me out. What can I say? Maybe it was divine intervention. I don't know. But I couldn't. I've never lived that down. But it did, it broke the ice and allowed me to harass her a little bit as she harassed the heck out of me. And it was the start of a good relationship.
Well, that's one of many charming stories in your book, Grounded, A Senator's Lessons on Winning Back Rural America. And also throughout the book, you talk about various ways you've struck out, but that you've learned from it and you've been accountable. And perhaps we'll get to a few of those. But I want to get back. So you married Sharla in 1977, and then in 1978, you two took over the family farm. And as you mentioned, you were 21, Sharla was 19. Now, the farm has grown to 1,800 acres. It's located west of Big Sandy, Montana. And there's just one county width between your farm in Choteau County and the Canadian border. You farm organically without irrigation. You served on your local Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Service Committee. That's now known as the Farm Service Agency. You were elected to the Organic Crop Improvement Association, and you served on its executive committee while also serving on its international board of directors. Now, that sets standards for 37 countries. You have continued to farm without hired help other than Sharla, while also working as Montana's senator, and you have resisted the get big or get out dicta of decades of government pronouncements and policies. So would you please talk about your approach to agriculture and how your experiences as a farmer inform your efforts now in the U.S. Senate?
Boy, Joy, that was that's an incredible introduction. I'll tell you that. That's the first time I've ever heard that. That's amazing.
Well, I'm just quoting what you wrote.
I know, but you put it all in one sentence, which is really amazing. And I will tell you how my approach to agriculture is, and I alluded to it a little bit earlier. Soil is really the most important thing there is on a farm, and you've got to take care of it. And look, I've had my share of disasters. I know what happens when wind erosion happens. I know what happens when you may have too many weeds or poor yield or whatever it might be. But ultimately, it's the soil. And if you build the soil, you can raise good food. So it's about making sure that you build the soil, that you have a rotation that works, it helps you control pests and weed cycles, and that you can be financially sustainable on that farm. Because if you go broke, it doesn't do you any good. So those are really the tenets of agriculture. In the bigger picture, I can tell you that, you know, we converted to organics in the 80s for a number of reasons. I didn't get along well with the chemicals, and neither did Sharla. And quite frankly, ag consolidation had been happening at both where you sell your products and the input level. It's gotten much worse in the last 40 years. But I was tired of not having any options, where I hauled my grain to town and they would tell you what's wrong with it. They would dock you for everything under the sun and cut the price on everything under the sun. And I just didn't get any sort of appreciation that I was doing anything but raising a commodity. I wasn't raising food. I was raising a commodity that they could set the price on the Chicago Board of Trade and I could take it or leave it. There was not any capitalistic principles in the marketplace because it was so heavily consolidated. So because of all those reasons, I converted to organic. And I'm going to tell you a quick story, and I don't even remember if I put this in the book or not, but the very first field that I harvested was durum. I'd never raised durum before on the farm. It had always been winter wheat, spring wheat, and barley. But I planted lentils and peas and durum. And I hauled the outside edge of the strip. You have to harvest separately because of potential spray drift or fertilizer leaching. And I hauled that to the conventional market in town. And it was about 4 acres. So it was nearly, 150 to 200 bushel of wheat. And I took it in there. And quite frankly, as they did usual, they told me what was wrong with it. And they docked this and that. And I walked out and I got my pickup with the check for not a lot of money, but it wasn't a lot of wheat. But I didn't really feel good about it because, geez, they kind of told you everything that you were doing wasn't working. And then the rest of it went to a place in Michigan in the organic market, stuff inside that border strip. And I happened to go to a convention because nobody else wanted to go to it. And that's why I got elected to those boards you talked about, International Certification Board and Executive Board. And I went to that and I saw the lady that contracted the durum from me. And I had just shipped the durum off to Michigan a couple weeks earlier. So they had gotten it, they had tested it, and they were in the process of making noodles out of it. And she came up to me and she said something that I'd never heard in my life. As a farmer, she looked at me and she said, "We got your durum, and it's the best durum we've ever gotten." And I went, "Holy mackerel. I finally found somebody that actually appreciates what we've done." They didn't tell me what was wrong with it. They didn't dock me for every little knickknack that was down the pipe. She came up to me and told me it was the best durum they'd ever got. From that moment forward, I had always had in my mind when we made the conversion to organics that I could go back if I had to. But that from that moment on, I said, this is where I'm at. This is where I'm at in my head, and this is what I'm going to do forever. I'm going to connect up. and I'm going to connect this farm up with the best processors we have, and I'm connect up with the consumers, and we're gonna do this thing organically. And I converted the whole damn farm in pretty short order. But the bottom line is that I don't care what job you're doing. I don't care if you're a school teacher. I don't care if you're in a factory making widgets. I don't care if you own a business. If you don't get positive reinforcement for the work that you do, that work isn't any fun. And agriculture wasn't any fun for me until 1987. And then it became fun because there was competition in the marketplace. People appreciated what you were doing. And I just love it. And I still love it to this day, by the way. I only do business with a couple, three or four different buyers, but I've built relationships up with those folks. They appreciate what I do, and I appreciate what they do. And that's where we're at in agriculture.
And you are the lone farmer in the U.S. Senate. Now, things were already difficult for people in the agricultural sector with Trump's trade war and particularly the tariff issues. But now with the COVID situation, you have had to really get even more active than you already were. And you were already very active because, well, explain to our listeners what the situation is now, both from the perspective of the tariffs and the issues around COVID.
Yeah, so the issues around the tariffs are, and anybody in production agriculture understands this, if we don't have foreign markets, then we are really in tough shape. We have to have foreign markets, especially in Montana. We do happen to raise the best grains and the best beef and best pulses in the world, and that's not brag, that's fact. But the bottom line is, if you don't have those foreign markets to be able to ship those products to, the wheat and the beef and the pork and the grains and the pulses, then you don't have much market, and it becomes very, very, very consolidated, and the prices are driven down. That's exactly what's happened with the trade wars. And I know the president talks about, well, we've signed this China agreement and we've signed that agreement. But if you look at those agreements, they're not being enacted. They're not very good agreements. And quite frankly, we've lost market share because of these trade wars that are out there. And by the way, on the tariff side of things, it's increased our input costs because we still have to do things like buy grain bins and cattle guards and all those kind of things. So the tariffs on aluminum and steel also have negative impacts. And I'm here to tell you that right now, farmers would, and this has been this way forever, and I hope it stays this way, farmers would rather get their check from the grain elevator or the marketplace, not from the federal government. And we've had to infuse billions and billions and billions of dollars into farm agricultural units. And it's never distributed appropriately, by the way. There's always people that take advantage of it and get more money than they should. There's always people that deserve more than they get. So it isn't a true market. It's quite frankly, the government writing checks to farmers because this isn't drought. This isn't bugs. This isn't disease. This is a man-made disaster. And the disaster was the negotiations and the trade wars that have gone on that have sealed off many of our markets and given them to places like Argentina and Australia. So the bottom line is we've got prices that are extraordinarily low at the farm gate. And by the way, if you take a look at the cattle industry, because of consolidation there, extraordinarily high at the marketplace. In the grocery store, the guy in the middle is making all the money. The grocer's going broke and the farmer's going broke on each end. It's just not right.
It kind of sounds like the situation a century and more ago Sinclair Lewis was writing about. Yep. Yeah.
That's why what Teddy Roosevelt did was so very, very important, the trust buster. Because he made it so capitalism could work. Capitalism doesn't work in a consolidated market. It does if you have competition. And if there's a monopoly, it certainly doesn't work. And so you're right. We're in many respects, we're where we were over 100 years ago. And we've got to do something about it. And by the way, there are laws on the books, like the Packers and Stockyards Act, that we need to enforce. And there are other bills. I've got several, in fact, that will help get more dollars down to the farm gate. But the bottom line is I don't have the votes here to get those done in Washington, D.C. which is a whole other debate we can talk about as far as the impact of money on elections and government. So we've got a situation in family farm agriculture where it has shown, this COVID crisis has shown that our food chain is not very strong and can be broken. If you take a look at the packing plant that went down in South Dakota, that put a lot of producers on the rail that had pork, and it increased costs. If you take a look at the beef packing plant that burned up a couple of years ago, that increased costs for consumers and lowered prices for producers. So if anything, we've got to do some things. If COVID has shown us anything, we've got to do some things to insert more competition in the marketplace and break up these doggone monopolies that aren't doing the country any good, certainly aren't helping with food security. But like I said, once again, there's farm groups out there that are controlled by those packers that will fight you tooth and nail because they've been told what to do, and that's what they do. It's very unfortunate, and it's not in the best interest of the ranchers or the folks on the farm. So that's kind of what COVID has shown us, is that our food chain is broken, and we need to make some adjustments, and hopefully Congress will make those adjustments. A lot of these laws were put on the books 100 years ago, and we need to pay attention to why they were put on the books, because I think the same problems apply today.
We're speaking with U.S. Senator from Montana, John Tester. His book, Grounded, A Senator's Lessons on Winning Back Rural America, has just been published by Echo Press. You do a wonderful job, Senator, in talking about Montana's particular history of resisting corporate control of elections and then revisiting Citizens United case, etc. But what it really comes down to is minority ruling majorities. And we now are at what some are considering another constitutional crisis with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the unseemly rapidity with which President Trump is trying to get her replacement onto the Supreme Court. I would appreciate whatever comments you have on that, however briefly. But then I want to go back to the idea of minorities ruling majorities, and particularly the role of the Electoral College. But first, any remarks you have about the current situation with the Supreme Court?
If you go back 4 years ago, we had Justice Scalia pass. And when President Obama put forth a candidate, Mitch McConnell said, we're not going to consider that candidate. We're not even going to interview that candidate. We're not going to do anything because, quite frankly, it's an election year and the voters need to speak. I did not like that decision. I thought it was silly. I thought we should have taken up Merrick Garland. I thought we should have given him a hearing. And I thought we should have voted on him and let the vote say what it does. But nonetheless, Mitch McConnell, who was the leader of the Senate then, made this rule, set this precedent. That happened probably, to my recollection, 7 or 8 months before the election, maybe even 10 months before the election. Now we have a situation where where Ruth Bader Ginsburg passes away last Friday. We're about 47, 48 days away from the election. And the same person, Mitch McConnell, says, well, what happened in 2016, we're not going to follow that precedent. We're going to go back to the precedent that was there before 2016. In fact, we're even going to speed this one through, because in normal cases, this close to the election, we wouldn't do it because we wouldn't have the time to get it done, because it usually takes a couple months to get a justice there. I think Ginsburg took 50 days to get her confirmed. But nonetheless, Mitch has said, no, the rules that I said in 2016, they don't apply. We got a different set of rules. So what's different? Well, it was a Democratic president in 2016. It's a Republican president today. And I'm going to tell you, if you want to put this country on its ear, start having different sets of rules for different people. You know, start having a different set of rules for rich people versus poor people, which, by the way, some would argue they're there. But when you do it this brashly, when you do it this intentionally, and you look the people in the eye and you say, I don't give a damn what the last president was. I'm doing it this way, and we're going to ram this new Supreme Court justice right down your throat. I'm going to tell you, I take offense to that. I think that's very poor leadership. I think long-term, you're doing far more damage to this country than you're helping the small group of people that you're trying to appease by putting in a Supreme Court justice without the proper vetting. And I got to tell you, I've told reporters this back here. This is going to change the way business is done in the United States Senate. You have to have trust if you're going to be able to do business with people. If you don't trust them, you can't do business. That's true in business. That's true in a marriage if you don't have trust. And it's true in government. And I think that what Mitch McConnell is doing here is a massive, massive mistake and puts this country at risk.
There are some who are speculating about changing the numbers of justices on the court. Have you given any thought to that, or what are your thoughts on that?
I really haven't given any thought to it, Joy. I think that what we really need to focus right now is trying to get four Republican senators to understand that fairness is something that's a basic value of this country. And when you do things that's just blatantly unfair, it's bad for the country. And then I think we also need to think about what impacts this justice is going to have on things like health care, on things like voters' rights, on things like dark money in campaigns, on things like our public lands, because quite frankly, it could have major impacts on all those things and a whole bunch more things. And so where I would like to focus on is the work we have ahead of us today, and that is talking about the impacts that this new Supreme Court justice would have on our everyday lives, which would be incredibly significant. We've got an election coming up. We'll see what happens in the election. But after that election, then we're going to have a lame duck, and we'll be talking about a number of things, including a package to help small businesses with COVID if we don't do anything before the election. I don't anticipate we will on that. But in the end, I will tell you that I haven't really thought about the court thing at all. I think it's more important to think about the impacts that this new justice is going to have on people's everyday lives. And I'm going to tell you, it's going to be significant. I personally don't think it's going to be good for the working people of this country and the small businesses.
Well, let's talk about some successes. There have been some really impressive ones. On August 4th of 2020, the Great American Outdoors Act was signed into law. And there are some who say it's the most significant environmental law passed in the last 50 years. Can you briefly share with our listeners what this act does? And thank you for your getting it passed.
The Great American Outdoors Act basically goes in two different areas. The first area is our national parks. The infrastructure in our national parks needs attention. There's a significant investment, I believe $15 billion, but don't hold me to it. But I think that's what it was, $15 billion investment in our national parks. At any rate, very significant investment in our national parks and the infrastructure of our national parks. So our national parks is the first area. The second area is there's a program called the Land and Water Conservation Fund, LWCF. That fund was set up in the mid-1960s. It was set up at $900 million per year to be taken off of oil and gas rental receipts. And it was to be used to help with access to our public lands. It was to be used to help expand our public lands. It was used to be able to fund parks within cities and tennis courts and those kind of things. And this bill fully funds it at that level, that $900 million level. So why is that important? It's important because there are ecosystems in the West, and Montana may be the state that has the vast majority of them, that aren't going to be around in another 10 years. Developers will buy them. They will build houses on them. We'll be fighting forest fires around them. And quite frankly, it's not good for our ability to be able to go hunting and fishing and hiking and biking and those kind of things. And this fund being fully funded will help willing buyer, willing seller preserve some of those lands for future generations so our kids can have the same or even better opportunities to be able to go out and enjoy the great outdoors. So it was a big bill. It was a great step forward. And I will tell you that Some of the people taking credit for it today were fighting against it just a few years ago. But for political reasons, they realized that they needed to switch sides. And I appreciate that.
Well, that is one of your gifts, sir, is to be able to work across the aisle and get people to change their minds about things. Now, you recently appeared at the opening in Billings of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Cold Case Team office. I'd like you to talk about that and also where the Savannahs Act and the Not Invisible Act are now.
I would tell you that the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women issue should be changed to Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, although women are in Native America are much more susceptible to it. I can tell you that when we brought this issue up for the Indian Affairs Committee a few years ago, there was a lot of resistance to even bring this up. And through the work Heidi Heitkamp did and when she was in the Senate, and this actually happened after she left the Senate, but she did some amazing work with missing and murdered Indigenous women. And I will tell you that it allowed me to really shame the committee, the chairman of the committee in particular, to take this issue up and have a hearing on it. And once that happened, it increased the awareness of this issue nationally. And there's been a lot of people, including many, many, many Native Americans in Montana, that have helped increase that awareness. In fact, my guest here a few years ago at the State of the Union was a person who has fought hard to make this issue real so that both the federal and state government will do something about it. And I believe the state government did do something about it, and that's good. And quite frankly, we've got a problem out there. And that problem needs to be solved. And as I said earlier, if you don't work on solving problems, they just continue to get worse and worse and worse. And I think we're seeing that with missing and murdered Indigenous women. Now, I know there was a report that came out recently that they're down a little bit, but keep this in mind. It all ebbs and flows. And even if one person goes missing and you can't find them and the case turns cold and then they forget about them, which happens far too often in our Native American reservations, then that is a huge hit to that family and those people. And things will never be the same in that small community or with that family. So we need to pass those bills so we can get additional law enforcement on the ground in Indian country so we can get better communication and move the ball forward on this issue. Because it's a real issue, and it's an issue that Congress needs to act on to get it solved.
I'm happy to report Savannah's Act and the Not Invisible Act were finally passed on September 21st, 2020, by a voice vote in the House of Representatives, and they are now waiting on the president's desk for his signature. Senator Tester, you have been an incredible advocate for veterans throughout your career in the Senate, and I dare say it goes back to your time as a boy playing the bugle at funerals for veterans. The president has recently been accused of calling people who served losers. What can you share with us about that situation?
Well, I can tell you that just not anybody. This is the greatest generation, the folks that died liberating Europe in World War II, he called losers and suckers. And I can tell you that he not only called those people who gave the ultimate sacrifice in Europe to free Europe from Nazi Germany of losers and suckers, he called everybody in this country a loser and sucker because of that. These are the people that helped make this country great. And look, I know he had a lot of bone spurs. He found a doctor that could tell the United States government that he got bone spurs so he didn't have to go to Vietnam. But to make those kind of statements at a cemetery, or when you're supposed to go to a cemetery that you didn't go to, is absolutely unforgivable. I don't care if you're who you are in this country. That crosses the line in my book. I played taps for many of those World War II folks through high school mainly. And I'm going to tell you what, the things that they did and what they saw, as with anybody who's been deployed to a war zone, was absolutely amazing. And the sacrifices that they made, the young men and women who were killed, that at a very, very young age, you never got to see life as I've been able to see it throughout my life. To call those folks suckers and losers is beyond my ability to understand. And it just shows a total lack of understanding of the role our military plays in this country, of our freedoms that they fought for. Think of what this world would have been like if the American soldier hadn't done what they did in 1941 and went in there and liberated Europe. Think what it would have been like with a dictator like Adolf Hitler running concentration camps and people throughout this world. That's what it could have been. But the fact is, those folks fought, and those folks were successful, and they did it for the good of the world. And so I don't get it. I don't understand it, but I do despise it.
And in your background, which we haven't talked about yet, is the fact that you were a teacher. And when it came to the confirmation of Betsy DeVos, you pointed out that she was the only person who required the vice president to break the tie in the Senate in order to confirm her in history. But what I want to get to is the current situation with education stabilization funds because of coronavirus and her not using the funds properly. What remarks can you share with our listeners about that?
So this is a prime example of putting somebody in charge of an agency that they don't believe in. She doesn't believe in public education. She's never spent one day in a public school classroom. And quite frankly, so when you put people in those positions, they tend to rip it apart. They want to voucherize it. They want to privatize it. They want to do everything they can. Now, keep in mind this. I told you about my grandmother and my mother. The fact of the matter is we would not have a democracy today if it wasn't for public education. So those people who want to voucherize it, they want to privatize it, that means you want to see the democracy go away, because only a select few will be educated. But what's made this country great is the ability to bring people together in a classroom and be able to teach people how to get along. And now they want to screw that up. They want to divide. They want to divide this country into classes, worse than it's already being done right now. And Betsy DeVos is at the top of that list. And I would just tell you that public education is incredibly important to me. I think it's one of the reasons my grandmother migrated from Sweden to this country, because of educational opportunity for her and her kids. And yet we have people who continue to try to rip it apart. I don't know what the long game is here, guys. I don't. If you're a patriot and you believe in democracy, why are you doing everything to rip apart the very foundation of that democracy? And that is what Betsy DeVos has done. So when it comes to distributing money, she doesn't want to distribute it fairly, equally, distribute it with common sense. She wants it to go to her agenda in her head. And her agenda in her head is to privatize public education, wipe it off the map, make it so people that are missing three fingers on their left hand can't go to a private school. Because, by the way, people with disabilities often are barred from it because they make sure that's the case. Use whatever reason you want, but ultimately it's a disability that they don't want. And public education has never done that. Public education has educated everybody, regardless of color of the skin, regardless of how rich or poor you were. They've done the job. And the best example I've got, my father was a homesteader. Cattlemen didn't like homesteaders. So when Grandpa had his kids and the cattlemen had their kids, guess what? They all went to the same school. That was my mother's generation. And they all found out how to get along. And things work a lot better when you can find common ground. And that's what public education has done for us, too. So I don't have a lot of respect for Betsy DeVos. She's in a position she should not be in. She was put in that position to try to destroy public education, and she's doing her damnedest to do that.
Well, Senator, we thank you so much for your generous sharing of your time with us. Any final remarks for our listeners?
Well, I'll tell you, if you have a chance and you want to buy the book or the audio version, I have read the audio too of it. Please do. I think it's a book that if you read it, you'll understand that we as Americans have far more in common than we have differences. In this divided day that we're in, and this country is very divided, just as Congress is very divided, I think it's an important message to get out there. So thank you very much, Joy. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Montana's senior senator, John Tester. His memoir, Grounded, A Senator's Lessons on Winning Back Rural America, has just been published by Echo Press. In the spring of 2017, Senator Tester spoke during the confirmation process of Betsy DeVos on her nomination for Secretary of Education. We broadcast his remarks. In many ways, they seem prophetic.
I rise today to address the potential confirmation of Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. I rise today not just as a senator from Montana. I am a former public school teacher, a former public school board member. I have a mother that was a teacher, an aunt that was a teacher, got a daughter that's a teacher, got a sister-in-law that's a teacher. I got a number of teachers in my family, okay? They all have either taught at or currently teach at public schools. So when I was growing up, education was a critical part of what we developed into. Public education was something that my parents thought was very, very important. That was instilled in them by my grandmother, who over 100 years ago immigrated to this country from Sweden, due in part to the public education system that we have in this country today. When I came home from school every day, my mother would quiz me on what went on in public education. By the way, I went to the same school that she did. And she would find out what had transpired, both the interactions with the kids and what went on academically in the school, and also offer me a hand if I needed help with the academic portion. We'd talk about my experiences in the public school because it was important. She knew it was important. She was the daughter of a homesteader. When she was a child, homesteading wasn't exactly looked upon kindly by the ranchers of the community. They thought that homesteaders were taking away their right to make a living, breaking up that good grass and putting wheat on it, making it so cattle couldn't continue to graze there. So there was a lot of friction between ranchers and farmers' kids. They all went to the same public school. In my particular case, it was Big Sandy Public Schools. And in that environment of that public school, those kids learned to get along. And what resulted from that was the greatest generation, a generation that we live in a world today due in much part to their figuring out a way to get along, figuring out a way to communicate, figuring out a way to make the world a better place. And that was due, I think, entirely because of the public education system we have in this country today. Our public education system is, and this is cannot be argued, it is the foundation of our democracy. When I was growing up and the Vietnam conflict was going on and there were conflicts around the world, everybody said, these countries need to have a democracy. And then there was a realization that without an educated population, democracies really don't work. We have had a democracy in this country for nearly 250 years. Because of the success of our public education system. We have had a middle class in this country that has been the envy of the world because of our public education system. It is the foundation of our democracy. It is the foundation of our economy. And it is a place where we learn to live together peacefully. What is troubling about the nomination of Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary is that she wants to privatize this public education system we have. I had her in my office. We talked about vouchers and we talked about privatizing education. We talked about accountability. And her response to the public education system was, as it was failing. So her response to that was, pull a few kids out. Pull the kids out that don't have any disabilities. Pull the kids out that are a little smarter and put them into a classroom. And that will be what makes this country great again. This country's already great. And if we do that, I am here to tell the people of the Senate today, we will destroy the foundation of this country. And we will destroy, and it may take a few years, we will destroy our democracy. Now, it would be different if Betsy DeVos had spent 1 hour, 1 minute, 1 second in a public education classroom. She was not educated in public schools. She's not dealt with public schools. I dealt with it as a teacher. I dealt with it as a school board member for 9 years. In fact, my second public service job was on the Big Sandy School Board. And it's important because my first one dealt with soil and soil conservation. My second one dealt with education. She has been in neither of those positions. And it doesn't matter that, quite frankly, that she wasn't in those, except it does. Because if you don't touch base with what's going on and to see the successes that are happening in public education, you can have a warped view of what's going on in this country right now. And that warped view will cause you to do things like say, you know what, we're going to put up charter schools and we're going to have vouchers and ultimately we're going to take away public education as we know it today. Instead of doing things like saying, you know what, we're going to invest in accountability. We're going to invest in teacher salaries. We're going to invest in a 21st century education system so our kids can compete. The answer is, no, we're going to pull kids out of the school. I'm going to give you a little secret. I taught in the late 70s, and I'm far from a master teacher. I taught for a couple years. I quit teaching because I could make money doing anything else in society and make more money. I could cut meat for a day and make as much money as I did teaching school for a week. So, wouldn't it be a little bit smarter, instead of privatizing the schools as Betsy DeVos wants to do, let's invest in those schools. Let's give the kids the maximum opportunity we can give them. Let's value public education. Let's value education. I'm going to tell you what happens in a rural state like mine with privatization. My school system in my hometown of Big Sandy has about 175 kids, and that is not an exception for Montana. There are a lot of schools that have 175 kids or less. And by the way, that's not high school, that's K-12. So let's say for whatever reason somebody wants to set a charter school up a few miles down the road and suck out a few kids out of Big Sandy and maybe suck out a few kids out of Fort Benton school system and a few more out of Chester system, and pretty soon they've got their little charter school and there is less money to teach the kids that are left in those public schools. What do you think is going to happen to those kids that are left there? It's going to take away from our public education system. Ultimately, it will cause those schools to close because the money that funds our education is at a bare minimum right now. The other thing that has happened in our public education system is that Congress, people here, have made the promise to local schools to fund kids with disabilities, IDEA program. One of the things we can do to help fix public education, let's fund it what we promised it at, 40%. It's funded at 16% right now. So if we had a person that was going to go into Secretary of Education and said, yeah, you know what, this is a problem, we're going to fight, we're going to make sure that folks have the money from the federal level to be able to teach the kids, and we're going to live up to our promise. And by the way, IDEA is a good program that needs to be fully funded, and the federal government needs to do their part at 40%. I may have a different opinion, but that's not what she wants to do. She, in fact, wants to do something far worse than that. She told me she wanted to block grant the money for IDEA, which would further put another nail in the coffin of schools around the country, and it'd put three or four into rural schools. It has been documented here earlier this morning that the phones have been ringing off the hook, and they've been ringing off the hook opposed to Betsy DeVos. There are 1 million people who live in Montana. Over 3,000 people have contacted me opposing her. I've had 20 contact me that support her. The phones are ringing off the hook. In fact, the phones are ringing to the tune of 1,200 to 1,500 calls a day. The phone system has shut down. There are some senators who aren't even answering their phone because they don't want to hear it. But the truth is public education is important in this country, and people know what's at risk here. And to have somebody who's never spent any time in the classroom of a public education system is asking for catastrophic results. I'm going to read a few comments from people in my great state who have sent me emails and letters about Betsy DeVos. Here's one from Mele in Missoula. Mrs. DeVos has no place in our national education system. She is clearly not prepared, nor does she even have the most basic experience to do this job well. Our students, our teachers, parents deserve an excellent candidate, and she's not it. Kelly from Laurel, as a mother of an 11-year-old daughter, the thought of this woman in charge of our nation's school system scares me. Sandy from Billings, it would be nice to have an education secretary who's actually worked, and I say worked, in education instead of some rich woman who's never spent a day in public schools. Kim from Kalispell, we need an education secretary that knows what the IDEA Act actually is and the needs of rural school districts. We can do better, and our kids deserve better. Janessa from Freud wrote me, now I want to back up a little bit and tell you Freud is a very small town, not unlike Big Sandy. It's got not a lot of kids, but great people. And here what Janessa says, after marrying my husband, a local farmer, in August of 2010, I put down my roots with plans to spend my entire teaching career in Freud, Montana. With Mrs. DeVos pushing for private school funding, our small school will be one of the first to suffer. Having two small boys that will be soon entering into their school years, they will be the third generation to walk the halls of Freud Public Schools. I want them to be able to spend all 13 years of their public school years in the same school. As an educator, I have seen what a small rural school can do for a student. While we may not get the same opportunity as large schools, when the opportunity knocks on our door, we have a large percentage of students take advantage. They have pride in their school and their community. Montana is currently suffering from teacher shortage. With a lack of funding, this shortage will only get worse. I am currently in process of earning my master's degree in educational leadership. With this degree, I've been given the opportunity to become the principal of our small school, a school my family attends. My roots are dug, and I do not want a woman like Betsy DeVos having control over our school. So please vote no. A vote for Betsy is a vote for private control. A vote for Betsy is against the community of Freud. A vote for Betsy is against Freud Public Schools. A vote for Betsy is a vote against public school teachers across this country and against the great state that you represent. A vote for Betsy is a vote against my family. And a vote for Betsy is a vote against me. Mary from Red Lodge, a 32-year veteran educator in a rural public school. I'm deeply concerned about the appointment of Betsy DeVos as education secretary. I'm inclined to say that her loyalty and financial backing of Mr. Trump were the reasons for the misguided appointment and not for her experience and knowledge of education issues. To be in such an esteemed position as education secretary, one would expect years of experience and an advanced degree to understand the ongoing issues that we're facing in the United States education. Sarah from Billings is a first grade teacher in a low-income school. I believe wholeheartedly in Montana's public schools. Betsy DeVos believes in school privatization and vouchers. She has worked to undermine efforts to regulate Michigan charter schools even when they clearly fail. The marketplace solution of DeVos will destroy our democratically governed community schools. Her hostility towards public schools disqualifies her. She will not work to provide a free and fair education to my students who struggle every day with hunger, with homelessness, and more. I'm asking you to vote against the confirmation of Betsy DeVos. But I've heard from far more than that. Parents to grandparents, to doctors, to average Joes who oppose this nomination. Education is something that affects everybody's lives. In my opening remarks, I talked about the need for public education for a democracy to work and exist. As a former school teacher and as a former board member, I can tell you there's a lot of things we can do to make public education better, and we ought to do it. They're hard things to do. It's much easier to say, let's just destroy the program and privatize it and then see what we end up with. That would be a bad decision. And that's why we should not vote for Betsy DeVos. The impacts are huge. They're huge on our economy. They're huge on our form of government. They are huge as us being a leader in this free world that we live in. In closing, I want Montanans to know that we've heard you. You've called, you've wrote, you've contacted me on Facebook, Twitter. Your message has been loud and clear. It's a message that we're hearing all across this country. It's a message that, quite frankly, if we confirm this lady, will not make America great again. It will, in fact, over time, destroy this very country that we love. And people that I talk to say, you know what, the Secretary of Education doesn't matter. It's not going to affect me. I don't know who you're kidding. The fact of the matter is this will affect every school in every community in this country. And we can say, you know, President Trump got elected and he needs to have the team that he wants. I am not going to vote for a team that destroys the public education system in this country. I would not be doing service to the people who came before me, the previous generations. I certainly would not be doing service to my kids and my grandkids and the generations to come after. This is an important decision, folks. This is a very important decision. If we want to do the tough work of debating our public education system and determining how we can make it better and get the best people in the classrooms and get the best academic material in there for them to work off of, let's do that. But let's not destroy the public education system that has made this country great for generation after generation after generation. I would urge my colleagues, Madam President, to stand with the thousands of Montanans and the millions of Americans who have told us to vote no on Betsy DeVos.
The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production recorded and produced in Bozeman, Montana by Joy LeClaire. You can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media. Till next time, this is Joy LeClaire, signing out for now.